Welcome to Cognis Education Untapped podcast, the show where we bring you experts and leading practitioners in the field of education.
Welcome to this week's podcast. It's a special one today for Down Syndrome Awareness Week.
We will be your hosts today. My name is Tamara Rainsley, one of the lead speech and language therapists at Cognis, and I'm joined by the lovely Emily Harnett, our specialist speech and language therapist for Down Syndrome.
They are parents, advocates, trainers, and valued sounding boards for our service initiatives. If that wasn't enough, throughout this lockdown, they've also been live-in teachers, SALTs, and OTs. So, without further ado, our two guests are Sarah and Lucienne. Thank you so much, Sarah and Lucienne, for joining us today. It's particularly special to be chatting to you both, as it is Down Syndrome Awareness Week here in the UK. And we've invited you both here to share with our listeners not only your experiences, but also tips that schools and other professionals can implement when working with someone who has Down syndrome and the families that support them. Before we begin, can we get our listeners acquainted by sharing a little bit about yourselves?
Thank you. Thank you for that lovely introduction. I'm Lucienne, also known as Lou, and I set up the local Down syndrome support group Get on Downs, which is in Sutton and surrounding areas, although we don't turn anyone away if anyone wants to join in the fun. I have a son, Billy, who is now aged 11. He goes to local mainstream primary school. He's on his journey going into year seven, so he's changing to a mainstream secondary school. So that will be a nice new adventure for us. I'm also part of Positive About Down Syndrome, which is a brand new national charity that raises awareness about Down syndrome, which Sarah can tell you more about in a moment. But I'm their maternity coordinator. So the aim of my little job is to get Positive About Down Syndrome in all maternity units within the UK.
Amazing. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sarah, and I have three girls. Hannah is 10, Beth 8, and Jessie 3. I spent a number of years working in community nursing, and then I was a clinical nurse specialist at St Raphael's Hospice in their home care team. I worked part-time when I had Hannah, but when Beth was born in 2013 and had Down syndrome, I decided to commit my time to being a full-time mum and supporting her as much as I could in all the things that we needed to do. So my youngest starts school in September, and I'll be looking to return to nursing next year, hopefully. So in the last few years, I've met lots of wonderful people, and I'm very proud to be a trustee at Down Syndrome Research Foundation and Down Syndrome UK, which oversees Positive About Down Syndrome. They're both national charities supporting people with Down syndrome and their families. And along with Lou, I'm also part of the Down Syndrome Policy Group, which will support a new all-party parliamentary group for Down syndrome, which is a really exciting initiative to be launched later this year, which will bring the voice of those with Down syndrome and their families to the heart of Parliament.
Thank you both so much for sharing. I think we should get right down to it. So I know experience is dynamic and not necessarily compartmentalised, and therefore, considering both of your personal journeys and all of the work you do, you both have a wealth of knowledge that I think is frankly imperative for professionals in various settings to consider, especially when working with people who have Down syndrome. Personally, I've relied on you both heavily over the last few years for your perspectives, resources, and support, which has just been so amazing for my professional development and our service development. And there are so many things that I would love to pick your brains about, but we would be here for hours, so maybe this needs to be a series. So the aspect I would really like to focus on today is your personal experiences within the early years in educational settings. And that's because at Cognis, we have a specialist service dedicated to the care and support of people with Down syndrome, and we are always looking to expand our skills and inclusive practice. So we thought, who better to chat to than you both?
Both of you spend a lot of time working on providing support and education for families and the professionals involved when there is a chance of a child having Down syndrome. Can you tell us a bit about what drew you towards this work?
I think I've always had a strong sense of justice from quite a young age, and I naively thought before having Beth that people with Down syndrome are equally valued and respected, and it came as a bit of a surprise to me that that's not always the case. When I was given the news that Beth had a 1 in 2 chance of having Down syndrome, I was advised to call in with my husband and speak to the screening midwife. She wasn't available, and when we went, we were taken to a dark, small office with a massive desk and uncomfortable chairs, and the receptionist brought in another lady to counsel us. She didn't introduce herself and proceeded to tell me that people with Down syndrome can do okay, but she didn't really know much about the condition. She was sort of nervously clutching a post-it note that read 1 in 2 risk of Down syndrome, mum is a nurse, want to keep it. So already I was kind of wrong-footed in being understood really. So then we were taken to the consultant, who asked me if I was sure I wanted to continue the pregnancy, as that's not what anyone else does. So before I'd even been introduced to him or got my coat off, I'd already had all this sort of negative experience. I later found that the woman who I'd initially spoken to wasn't even qualified. She was just an administrative assistant. And I think having worked in the NHS, I just couldn't believe that this was the sort of care that we were getting. This is, you know, this care would have been unacceptable in my employment. So it was really hurtful because, you know, I wasn't really treated with respect and dignity. And the assumption was that Beth wouldn't be wanted because she had Down syndrome. And I assumed I was just unlucky in my experience. But it became very clear when speaking to women across the country and locally that this actually is quite common. And so people are told all about the medical conditions a baby may have without putting it in any kind of context. And people have had terminations booked without any discussion about what they want to do. So I felt very hurt and angry, and that things needed to change. And from meeting like-minded mums, together we formed Positive About Down Syndrome, which helps share the personal journeys of those with Down syndrome and their families, and put some of those fears and worries that people have into context. For example, Beth needed heart surgery at 6 months, which a small number of babies may need. But what they don't tell you is that the success rate is extremely high and the average stay about 8 to 10 days in hospital. So it was a real drive to get proper information about the lived experience out to people so that they weren't frightened.
That was amazing. Thank you.
A bit of an essay.
No, it absolutely needs to be heard. And I knew a bit of that, but I didn't know the full bit. And from the get-go, day one, you know?
Yeah.
That's a really, I'm so sad that that's been people's experiences.
When you think she was the size of a bean or whatever. But I think the thing is, for the therapists, that maybe we need to make clear is that by the time we met you, we're already exhausted by experiences in the past. So when you come across as a bit tetchy or a bit demanding or a bit tricky sometimes, it's that they've got all this baggage.
And you've got a bank of negative experiences already. So you're kind of expecting your next experience to maybe not be so positive.
Yeah, well, you don't particularly trust your therapist until you get to know them well enough and understand what their motive is, what their knowledge is, how they can help. You know, are they going to invest or are they going to disappear off somewhere else or maybe move somewhere else? Because you're constantly making different friendships and relationships, and it's very hard when one moves or you're given to somebody else and you have to start all again.
Yeah, I wrote in, I think in that piece that I wrote for Positive About Down Syndrome, I wrote to other therapists the importance of remembering by the time these families get to us, they have been through so many experiences we'll never understand. That those first few meetings are about building a relationship and kind of, you know, taking whatever anxieties or stress or frustrations families have, because you know, we're ready to get started and you guys are years into this journey. Some positive experiences and some not positive experiences already.
Yeah.
So I think that is extremely valid. That was such a nice answer. Thank you so much for sharing.
Well, as Sarah has said, there certainly was a total lack of support in the beginning. And I guess that's what spurs you on. If you've had a child with Down syndrome, you're scared because of the negative experiences that you get at a hospital. I think further on down the line, as you realise that there wasn't any reason to be scared and you've wasted so much emotion and stress on what might happen and what you fear might happen, I think that drives you on. Certainly, as Sarah said, we've tried to make changes in our local hospitals that we now provide them with congratulations packs and pregnancy packs to ensure that new parents get the information that they need at that point in their life in terms of their having their child with Down syndrome. When I had Billy, similar to Sarah, I was given a leaflet that was very medical. It was almost like the person that gave me the diagnosis of Down syndrome was just looking on her desk for something to give me, and she found that and it would do. And it contained information, scary information about the risk of leukemia, dementia and life expectancy. And my baby hadn't even been born. And that was my first experience. And like Sarah says, as through the group and through Positive About Down Syndrome, this happens throughout the country. So I think that drives us on to try and make a change to make sure that everybody doesn't have those bad experiences. But also going into education with Billy, also I guess because there seems to be a lack of specialisation and a lack of understanding of what kind of support children with Down syndrome need, that they need more than the bare minimum. They also they have the right to thrive at school like anybody else. And there's been so much research about how children with Down syndrome learn, decades, literally decades of research. And most of that is ignored or not implemented. And that has to change. So it's, I guess, our children are striving us forward to make sure that they have the right to have to a successful education and life in society. I guess that's what drives us, isn't it?
I feel like I'm going to get emotional.
I know.
It's really, I know that we've had discussions like this casually and over the last, I've been in this role 2 years now. But it's just, I'm really excited to share this with others because I think this is what motivates me every day. And I'm excited for other therapists to hear this because I think it'll ignite some things in some people. So fantastic answers. Thank you.
What I'd really like to see is speech and language therapists and OTs really appreciate the job they have. It's almost that like they don't realize, because the reason we fight, you know, and sometimes go to court or tribunals and all the rest is because we value the profession, and sometimes it feels like the profession doesn't value itself enough, you know, doesn't push for the therapies. You know, almost talk yourself out of a job, that if a child only needs two sessions, you think, well, why bother? So you know, all our nagging comes from a place of really valuing our therapists.
And like having the therapist that you know and trust, rather than having to find another therapist or build rapport with another therapist and trust a new person and tell them your whole life story. I think that's a really, really like valid point.
Mm. Well, Beth had 5 speech and language therapists before she started school.
Wow,
some of them I never met. You know, I never met them or spoke to them. So you know,
and that's emotional labor. That's the emotional labor that parents go through as well. And you know, it's just I know that you guys do it because they're your babies, and you'll do anything for them. But I think that should be remembered as well, how much time and energy it takes for you to get to know a therapist, build your trust with them. It's two-sided, and we can't just expect the parents to lead that initiative. Therapists do need to reach out.
Well, it's not just getting that relationship with your therapist. A lot of therapists have different ideas as well, don't they? So it's the child getting you to do, you know, one therapist's way of doing things, which might be successful. Or not, to another, you know, to another therapist that's got a whole different, another right set of ideas. And if we have a single specialist like we have, then we know that we're getting that continuity, we're getting that specialisation. I mean, what more do we want? And it's not tricky, is it? Well, from our point of view, we are a small population. It shouldn't be that tricky. That's the whole point of it, isn't it?
I found once the service was really established and I found my rhythm and the main thing was getting to know you guys and being, you know, coming to get on Downs and all of that was really important for me establishing my style and my consistency. And now that I feel like I've got that, it's not rocket science. It's following the most evidence-based practice. But the thing that I think makes our work the most successful is families' perspectives and the child's perspectives. So, you know, what do you want to work on this term? How are things going at home? Is there anything popping up that we need to cover? I think that is the kind of key ingredient to making these children successful.
No, it's true.
So you have both shared some incredible resources with me, with your community and nationally through your work. How important and impactful is it for professionals involved to use the right language in those early stages? Is there anything you would want professionals to remember and consider? Sarah, you touched on your pregnancy experiences and the language and the resources that you were given. I would love for you guys to expand on that if possible.
So language really matters, because out of language you create reality. And so, for example, you know, any woman that's been to the hospital for antenatal screening will probably be told her risk that a child may have Down syndrome. And risk is a word that's often used, it's still used, it shouldn't be used, but we still hear it used an awful lot. And, you know, the word risk is something to be feared and avoided. And that word is being used to describe our babies and children. So, you know, straight away, it's, you know, an undignified language that doesn't, you know, respect them. And, you know, Lou and I would say Beth and Billy are no risk to anybody. So that, you know, that has been a real battle to get the NHS to change its use. And we'll still keep going with that. We've generally got much better at phones people with Down syndrome using person first language. And that matters, because having Down syndrome is just a small part of who they are. In fact, it's probably the least interesting part, I would say. You know, they're a baby, a child, or an adult first. And when, you know, if the midwife says to you, "Oh, you're having a Downs baby," the first thing you think about is Downs, not the little baby that's going to need warmth and feeding and love and cuddles from the family. So, you know, that's really important. But more important than the language is that people really understand why we do these things. We don't want people to feel tongue-tied or they have to think that this is the right way to use. We want them to understand the reasoning, because once you change kind of your attitude towards people, the language will flow quite naturally, really.
Beautiful. I'm going to use snippets of these the rest of my life just for sharing them.
Not quite.
Yeah. That was a really nice summary about the power of language and changing behaviour.
Yeah, well, you know what it's like when it first started having diversity talks. You think, well, I'm not allowed to say that. And rather than it's not that you're not allowed, it's that you won't want to say it because you realised the impact it has.
I was going to add to that was when you're talking about language, also sign language is such an important thing as well. As they get older, I think it's really important that professionals understand the important sign languages for our children, mm-hmm. because they're such great visual learners, and also that their language, because of the speech impairment that they have, their language will be slower to develop. And signing it, for some of these children, sign language is their only form of communication in the early years. Professionals to use sign language would be fantastic if they all learnt a bit, so that they could communicate with these children, and also the children could communicate with them, and it avoids any kind of frustration and behaviour. So you'll get more out of them if you're able to communicate with them directly.
Yeah, definitely. And also teaching how they learn is so important as well.
I think I really like that point about sign language as well, because a lot of the research says even if these children do become really competent verbal communicators, sign language is always important for them to fall back on, because often these children have a lot of things going on and they're learning new things. all the time and they're managing sensory needs and trying to listen to new information. So it's important that we always have that sign language element, even if they're perfectly competent, just verbal communicators. So I think that's a really important point that sometimes I think we can forget as professionals, because we see them communicating, chatting away, they seem to be following, and we think, oh, we don't need to sign, they've got it. But actually we do. So that's a really good reminder.
Yeah, it's certainly with Beth's interest. Beth will be far more interested if it's accompanied with sign. Mm-hmm. So she can sign pretty much the whole of Million Dreams from The Greatest Showman, but she couldn't sing. She couldn't sing it. The word.
Yeah.
The sign. She'll. You know, the combination of the two, she can get through the whole song. So sometimes with school, you know, there's a frustration when they've chosen to show a song that isn't signed, when there's 20-fold. That they could just use that are signed. Yeah. That's a really easy thing and makes a big difference.
Definitely.
It also makes them feel included, because I help out at the Brownies, which I really didn't ever want to do, but they were struggling a bit with Beth, so I thought, oh, I'll have to go. So anyway, I was just going to go and help Beth, and before I know it, I'm having to teach the whole Brownie pack the signing for the promise that they have to say, and, you know, get them their language badge. So it was quite intense, but all the kids loved it. It was really nice that it was just something they could all do rather than Beth perhaps struggling. It was something that actually she was pretty good in.
Sign language for our children isn't helpful. As you said, you know, how helpful it is. It isn't helpful. It's essential, I think. And it's essential that schools realise that if they're going to get the best out of those children, that they need to know sign language, certainly to a, especially those, well, for the teachers, it needs to be of a certain level. The teachers and teaching assistant, they need more than just the basics. If their child in reception with Down syndrome goes in who's predominantly signing, it's more than useful, it's essential.
But for topic work, it doesn't mean you've got to know the whole signing dictionary. It's just if you're doing a topic on the Great Fire of London, at least know what a castle and a fire is.
Definitely.
That core key vocabulary for them. And, yeah.
And it's definitely one of those things, like a lot of strategies are really good for everyone in the class. Like you said, Sarah, like it's nice that everyone can do it together. And actually those children that don't have Down syndrome would learn those topic words even quicker if they had a gesture or a sign to go with it. And I just think it's so important to make it visual and inclusive, and that everyone's kind of able to do the same task and the same routine together.
Yeah.
I can still remember some of the signs to some of the hymns we did at primary school. It's a bit embarrassing.
But the children, you're right, the children do love the signing, and they love they want to be our children's friend as well, don't they?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of children are drawn to other children with Down syndrome. And I think they love the signing element. I think they really enjoy it.
Absolutely.
But I was using it with my friends just to practice. And, you know, within the school environment, they could all practice with each other if they're given that support and motivation, I guess, to just sign things when they go into the staff room to, you know, say, you know, what do you want to, and, you know, things like that, and make it more part of the whole the school situation,
more embedded rather than here this is what we're going to learn, this is separate to, this is a functional part of your everyday communication.
Absolutely.
Well, certainly when Lou and I go to a noisy bar, it's no problem working out what drink you want from some distance, or that you've had enough already.
Do you do that as well?
I do as well. If I'm moving, I'll be like, ready to go, and then my friends will be like, what are you saying? And then a few of the other speech therapists also know signs, so often, like, if you're ready to go home, you'll be like, are you ready to go home now? And then other people are like, what's going on here? So it's definitely practicing and embedding it into like your everyday life, isn't it? I remember when I was learning sign language, I woke up one day and I had a dream in sign language, and I was like, oh my goodness, what's happening? I'm so confused, like, what language am I like thinking in? But yeah, definitely. And I think also for a child that signs, if they could had to go to reception or deliver the register back, having the receptionist able to say like, hello, how are you? Or something just to support that spoken language and making sure it's consistent across the whole school. Especially thinking that every year your teacher might change. But I think that is definitely a really key part of maybe a whole school kind of embedded approach.
Yeah, I like this. This is why these conversations are important. At Cognos, we do a lot of work around key language and we share with schools and colleagues the importance of using this. Some resources we use are the hashtag NobodyToldMe and the resources for Language Creates Reality. You can find both of these on our Twitter. So something you have both taught me over the years is the importance of working relationships and partnerships between families and professionals. You've both worked tirelessly to create and maintain those. Can you share a little bit about what the support groups and community have meant to you, particularly in those early days?
Well, I can answer that to start with, because I didn't have that because in the early days. That's why I made my own. When Billy was born, I asked to be put in contact with the local Down syndrome support group so that I could connect with young families, and they told me they didn't have any young families, so I kind of flailed around for a bit and had to find out a lot of information myself, but then obviously you connect with other charities, and I think the really so massively important for me, Get on Downs is like my therapy, because I really enjoy, you know, helping people and sharing the knowledge that I've gained over the years through having Billy, and seeing that those new parents are less fearful than I ever was in those days. If only there were more people ahead of me so that I could learn from them. There are, you know, on a wider scale, but locally, I think your local Down syndrome support group is so important because they know how things work within your NHS trust, within your local authority, and we share kind of therapists and paediatricians and things. I think that support has been quite invaluable for new parents. What do you think, Sarah?
Yeah, definitely. There wasn't anything available to me when I had Beth either, but I was very fortunate in that Lou and I had a mutual friend, and so she introduced me to Lou, and you know, that made all the difference to me. To have a friend that would come in and, you know, just pick Beth up and not be worried about her having an NG tube or that she was going to drop her or break her or that she was really small. You know, I didn't have to explain anything. And then Lou would tell me what profession I needed to ring, and she'd probably have a telephone number for them. And that can cut down on so much work when you're, you know, trying to find your way around what are often very complicated systems, you know, and you end up having to go through the main switchboard, and you can be on there for hours, and it can be really, you know, quite hard going, especially when you've got a new baby that to manage as well. So having inside knowledge is invaluable. But we also find that actually lifelong friendships emerge, even if they're just online. You know, we have a network, a national network right across the country, you know, uniting people from Cornwall right up to Hull. And you know, those people take an interest in each other's children. They're genuinely delighted when a baby learns to do something. They'll support them if the baby's got reflux or constipation or all of those things. You know, they'll share advice. And it's actually really heartwarming to see. And I think, you know, most people in our community would admit that it's not a support group that they would want to join. It's not one that they think, oh, great, you know, when they first find out. But actually what they do realise, it really is the best club, because we are a genuine community of people that are thrown together from different walks of life, different backgrounds. And at the beginning, all that we have in common is Down syndrome. But actually, you get to know people very quickly and very well, probably more so than friends you might have had for years. And out of that, you develop genuine friendships.
I think as well, in the early days, if you are fearful of Down syndrome, if you know nothing about Down syndrome, for me it was really, really nice to know that it wasn't just me. I felt like I was the only one. None of my friends had children at that time, had children with Down syndrome. Now practically all of my friends have Down syndrome. syndrome. Think that you're the only one and nobody understands. And through those support networks, you realise you're not the only one. We do understand, and we can all help each other with those things that we're worried about.
Yeah, and I think for me, I'm somebody who likes to just get on by myself, really. I'm not a great group, you know, I don't really like going to kids groups. I never did it much with Hannah. And then this thought that I was going to have to be going to support groups really, you know, it made me really kind of nervous. But I've been totally won round, because I just think they're totally invaluable, and they're not as you imagine them to be at all. They're places of great fun and great friendship, really.
I would say as well, in terms of get and downs, I thought what would make me want to go to a support group, and I thought good coffee. Support groups have very bad and cheap coffee, and also cake. Cake, never underestimate the value of therapy. So at our support groups, we get proper filter coffee. We get a homemade cake most weeks, and that kind of helps things along, I think.
Absolutely. I remember coming to my first Get On Downs meeting, and there was coffee and cake, and I thought, oh, I like it here. As often as I'm invited. I was so nervous to come that day, because I thought, you know, I'm going to be around all of these parents. They're going to want to know all of these things about me. And it was just the best day. And I just left. I remember coming back to the office and saying, wow, that was really cool. That was really good. And it just, I just, and I've actually written something here. I said that, you know, I've been so honored to be able to participate in those groups. And I hope that this encourages other professionals to get involved, because it really does help your clinical practice, but also just getting to know these families as people, as they are, and getting to know their children as children makes such a difference to the support you provide these families, and also the support that I've got back as well. It's not one-sided. Whenever I've needed anything, any ideas from you guys, or, you know, Sarah and Lou, you've both messaged me, emailed me, posted me physical resources of things that you've got that I maybe hadn't heard of, because you're right, there is an overwhelming plethora of evidence out there. So it's just, I really hope this encourages other professionals to get involved, because it's a win-win for both sides.
Okay, so a big part of your work has been around changing the negative stereotypes about preconceived ideas around Down syndrome. I know there are many myths to dispel. Do you have anything you want to dispel today or think others should know?
Well, in terms of things about Down syndrome that I didn't know when I had Billy, is that it's not just the older mother that has a child with Down syndrome. The average age of a mum of a child with Down syndrome is actually 29. Now that was a myth that I didn't know about when I had Billy. What else do you think, Sarah?
I was going to say that one of the myths with Down syndrome is that they're all the same, that if you've got Down syndrome, you're going to look the same and you're probably going to have similar personalities. And I think the biggest thing to remember is all these children with Down syndrome are individuals first and foremost. They look more like their families than each other. And while they may share a learning style, that's really much as far as it goes. And like I said, you know, the Down syndrome really is just a small part of who they are. You know, if you wanted to know about Beth, well, she dances, horse rides, swims, enjoys reading, watching films. She's on the trampoline. She's popular class member and pupil. She's starred in Call the Midwife Christmas special. It's all Andy. She's not always happy and joyful. She can be very stubborn and grumpy. And she's just like any child that experiences a full range of emotions. So I think really see that child within the context of their family and the individual that they are, because if you tailor the learning to what they're interested in, you're going to find they switch on much, you know, much more readily and be more interested in what they're doing.
I think as well, not to be afraid. I think if you don't know anything about Down syndrome, it's quite easy to be swayed by all the negative stereotypes, like you've said. So, you know, don't be afraid. It's not the life with Down syndrome now in the 21st century is nothing like it was even in the 20th century. Things move so quickly, and the support and the knowledge about Down syndrome, people with Down syndrome, is moving on all the time. So don't be afraid. It is all doable. There is a lot of support out there. I think that's just something that I remember when I had Billy, that I was really afraid. And because Sarah mentioned Call the Midwife, I now need to tell you that Billy was in a film called Lost in London. He had a very small part of the film. I mean, this is just us blowing our own trumpets about children. But what it illustrates is that these children have taken us on a journey which we never knew which we would be on, and we never knew would be such fun, I think.
Mm. Yeah, you're, I mean, absolutely talk up your children, because they bring so much joy because of the children they are, not because they have Down syndrome, because the people that they are. And I think one of my favorite, I don't know if it's a myth, but one of my favorite kind of learnings over the last few years is there is no proven glass ceiling or limit for a child or young person who has Down syndrome. The evidence shows it. So it's a world of possibilities that I don't think people quite realize yet, or not everyone realizes yet, that that's the current situation, that, you know, there are no limits. And if we put the right support and intervention into place, it's really exciting seeing what these children and young people can do.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point.
So thank you so much for sharing your stories and time with us and the listeners today. Before we finish up, we would love to know if you have any advice on how we as professionals and the public can combat issues of inclusion and work to support people who have Down syndrome.
I would like to just reiterate about teaching children with Down syndrome. Professionals really need to think about including their pupils with Down syndrome, especially within a mainstream setting, where our children are so good at learning from other mainstream peers. I think it's like you've said, Emily, teaching children with Down syndrome, we now know that they're lifelong learners. And I think all professionals need to know that. And also, I think there's a need for specialist teacher training for pupils with Down syndrome. We now have specialist speech and language therapists to help their unique way that they learn to speak. They learn in a unique way too. It's not something that you can get from any other form of disability, I guess. That we need specialist Down syndrome teachers to maximise all that research that's been done on the way that people with Down syndrome learn. I think also professionals need to learn to listen to parents, but make sure they do listen to parents, to take time to understand the complexity of their child's needs. Our views are important, as we know our children the best. And I think professionals could learn a lot from the things that parents know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think seeing the child in the context of their family and the things that they like to do is really important, because it gives you sort of background conversation of what they've perhaps done or what they like to do, if they've got photos to back up what they do out of school, where they're perhaps not able to share something exciting they've done verbally, at least to be able to show that to the class. Certainly with Beth, the school have been really good at using her friends, you know, her natural friendships and peers to help her with learning. So she's in a phonics group rather than sort of taught on her own. And she responds well in that. And, you know, she really does learn from her peers. Mm-hmm. So if they're doing a task, she'll respond much better if another child is showing her where to put the glue or the glitter or whatever it is that they're doing. It really works well to use the peers. Definitely, as Lou said, about equipping the school with, you know, effective tools, so expertise from outside, because Lou and I have learned all this as we've gone along. And for a teacher, they're sort of told in September you've got a child with Down syndrome, they may not even have ever met anyone with Down syndrome. The problem is, if you don't get it right in the early days, you can find, you know, behaviours start to develop, and it can be hard to get get back. So, you know, having a good handover and somebody to hold their hand in the first few days and weeks to get that child really settled in into class and school. And to aim high, I think, to try and include them in every aspect of school life, and, you know, outside as well in activities, so that you're not always having to go to something that's specialist for children with Down syndrome, but a lot of mainstream things. Because whereas Beth might not let on that she understands, or you might think it's a waste of time, what I see when she comes home is perhaps a conversation or something that she can do that she couldn't do before, and that's because she's been in a mainstream environment.
I think Sarah's right as well about after school support. That's another way. Inclusion isn't always apparent in after school support. Mm-hmm. That's after school club and other external clubs. And in terms of the public, I guess, and friends and family, how to help support and include our children is to give them a bit of time to process what you've said, and don't write them off. Include them in parties, invite them to your children's parties, and make sure that they're supported in any kind of out of school activities that they're interested in.
That's so great. Those are really nice answers. So let's level up now.
Yeah.
Oh, great. The only way is up. Guys, I really enjoyed that conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time. And I'm sorry for the last minute questions, but I thought your answers were beautiful. It's been a pleasure as always. And I'm so excited for everyone else to kind of hear what this community is like and get involved.
Amazing.
Great. We'll put some links up on our Twitter this week. We'll be covering something every day. But happy Awareness Week.
Thank you. This is a great start. So thank you so much. Lovely to meet you tomorrow as well. Thank you for your support. Well, this is brilliant. Bye. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Cognos Education Untapped podcast today. We hope you have enjoyed our Down Syndrome Awareness Week resources that we've put online this week. And we will put all the details about Get On Downs and Positive About Down Syndrome in the description, so you can have a link to their website. If you like this session today, join us next time. And to find out more about Cognos, visit our website at cognos.org.uk. Bye.
Bye.